Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for all things Kings of War. Join your hosts, Mark Zielinski, Jeremy Duval, and Rob Phaneuf as they delve into the world of Mantica and bring you in-depth coverage of all things Kings of War.
Hello, gentle listeners. Welcome to Countercharge. I'm Dan Reed.
I'm Jordan Legros.
And I am Mark Zielinski. Welcome to another episode of the Narrative Workshop. I'm very excited that you joined us today. Our topic for today is the fluff in Kings of War, from Edge of the Abyss to the COC 18 book. I'm really excited. As you heard before, we've got Dan and Jordan joining us today on our journey. So how you doing today, guys?
Great. Good to be here.
Good. Thanks.
Fantastic. Well, I think it's time to get going. Dan, why don't you go ahead and take it away, O Tour Guide.
Okay, so a brief overview and recap. The Edge of the Abyss campaign was some time ago now. In fact, I think it was even last year. So Mantic organized a worldwide campaign for people to chip in and play games, and this would then affect the fluff and the map of Mantica. They produced a book called Edge of the Abyss, in which they set up the various battlegrounds and various situations and various characters that would be fighting in the conflict. And I'm going to do a quick overview of the story so far. So the main part of the story was that the Abyss was starting to grow, and it had swallowed up the Brotherhood lands, causing quite a few Brotherhood players to be a bit sore about that. And the forces of good were rallying to try and stop the inevitable apocalypse of demons rampaging through the lands. So you've got the area of the Abyss that's growing, and the scattered remnants of the Brotherhood running all over the place. Presumably also the Basileans marching to fight directly with the Abyss, seeing as they're quite near. Then Rindufaris, which is to the west, I believe. The Abyssal Dwarves were moving out from their homelands of Tregar, forcing the Free Dwarves of the Halpi Mountains to flee southwards and hoping to build a golden bridge across the Great Cataract to basically invade the lands of the Imperial Dwarves under King Golok. This could mean, obviously, the end of the Dwarves and the reign of the Abyssal Dwarves. Characters involved in these situations, there was Bannock Kolarm, who was a disgraced Dwarf Ranger who turned into a miner, and he had an allied Greater Earth Elemental called Kragoth. Presumably, they're fighting in this area. The Abyssal Dwarf Dravak Dalkan, who had been merged with his golem Infernok, presumably he was also fighting there. Then over in an area called Hawk Man, the Empire of Dust Ammonites had raised a dead fleet to sail across the Infant Sea and had incurred the wrath of the Trident Realms, who'd pledged to stop them. The characters involved in this conflict were Arcanton, I think that's the way it goes, and his restless souls, who were skeletons who threw bombs, which was pretty nice. Then the Twilight Glades was another area of battle, in which an elf called Lathael Silverheart had accidentally, possibly, let some very nasty creatures from another dimension into Mantica via the opening of the ways, and had also become quite twisted and corrupted by this. And so you had some elf characters who were a little bit possibly evil. Then the Ordovician Plain, which I believe is in the human lands. The orcs had decided to invade the successor kingdoms. That's the kingdoms of men who are not quite as good as the Basileans. And they were building a wall in the Dragonteeth Mountains and using ogre mercenaries from the ogre lands to defend against the orc hordes. Grokka Magok, the famous ogre leader, had sent his advisor and great friend Nomagorok to meet with the Green Lady in what I believe it was called the Council of Captains. The orc character was called Grumtongue. He was carrying Gakkamak's banner, and he was attempting to invade these lands. The next area was the forest of Galahir, where the Green Lady lives, and the forces of nature. And the goblins had attacked and started to burn the forest while the Green Lady's worried about the Abyss. And they were using the wood chopped down from the trees to make horrible, horrible war machines. The interesting character in this situation was Grogga Splittooth, a would-be king of the goblins who thought that his chance for power was to basically burn down the forest of Galahir. He's able to see the future by means of a magical brew, but it gives him conflicting visions, some of which are good and some of which are bad, but he goes with it anyway. There was another character involved in this scenario called the Centaur Chief Flaxhoof, who had been raised from the dead by the Green Lady. Interesting. Necromancy, possibly. To protect the Green Lady and drive off the goblins. Then we have the special characters that Mantic produced some lovely miniatures for in resin for the first time. The Abyssal Temptress Mauti Busu, who her part in the story was, she was searching for Gilberto's vault, which was on the outskirts of the Golden Horn in Basilean territory, looking for an artifact of Ophidia, which would possibly speed up the growth of the Abyss and basically ensure that they conquered the world. Then we've got Salamander hero Artackle, who was also searching for the artifact and trying to get there before Mauti Busu did, so that she couldn't have it. She works with Ector in the story and encounters Mauti Busu actually at the vault. So maybe they had a fight, but who won? Ector from the Trident Realms, Placoderm champion, his job was to ensnare a Kraken to fight with the Trident Realms, the biggest one ever created, apparently. He gets the call to come and help the Green Lady. Apparently they have a back history, and he's promised to help her as a result of her doing him a favor once before. Wonder what that was. Then we have Jarvis, the good necromancer. I think possibly everyone's, quite a few people's favorite from this particular bit of fluff. He's a good necromancer. He's obsessed with the secrets of Ophidian necromancy. He's stolen a book and he's on the run and he can raise undead armies. So what happened to him? And then we've got a Varanga female character called Magnild, who's quite a good sort of fighty, seemingly quite brutal character, who is also involved. And as we see her in Edge of the Abyss, she's actually supplying Jarvis with what appears to be body parts for his necromancy. So they seem to have some sort of existing relationship. We're not quite sure what that is. When they meet, they overhear Artackle and Ector talking about what's going on with the Abyss, and they offer to help. And basically, that was how things were left in the Edge of the Abyss supplement. The campaign was then fought by us and reporting our results and so forth. And on the whole, it was a win for the forces of good, with the forces of evil possibly only winning through in one location. So then we've just had Clash of Kings 2018, the book, which promises to resolve some of the fluff, give us the result of the campaign, and show us what has changed. So we will talk about that. Jordan, what were your opinions on how things were left in the Edge of the Abyss book, fluff-wise?
I think there's a lot of interesting potential for expansion. Some of the things that I thought were really interesting were some of the comments on elementals. There's expanded content on the greater elemental, the named greater elemental of the dwarves, as well as a named greater elemental that I believe is part of the forces of nature. And it was interesting to me that the perspective was different between the two. Did you catch that?
I didn't actually.
Well, let me refer to my book here. The story at the beginning, where they're doing some summation on the different characters and outcomes. It's the bit on Kragoth. So Bannock, Bannock and Kragoth, and you know, Kragoth appears to have fondness for the dwarves, and that seems to be mutual. It mentions, you know, the younger dwarves clambering about his back. So he's, you know, kind of an amusement park ride, and him being very gentle with them. And Bannock, you know, former ranger, now miner, and now he's looking at perhaps learning the secrets that he would need to become a stone priest in order to keep Kragoth alive. So the sense that I got from this is that Kragoth is a construct, was built for a purpose, and as that purpose is concluded, there may not be a way to you know, top off his tank, as it were, and have him keep going. So I thought that was kind of an interesting departure on looking at elementals as spirits versus just energy, which has been encapsulated.
Yes, and from being just automatons to perhaps being creatures in their own right. Just to recap, that's a bit that's in the Clash of Kings 2018 book, which is the conclusion to the Rin Dufaris section. So the free dwarves have been forced completely out of their homes and forced to cross the Great Cataract, and they're now living with Golok's dwarves in that land. And there's general feelings of triumph and all that they've defeated the Abyssal dwarves. And there's a little bit of fluff in which, yeah, you see the celebrations and Kragoth is carrying dwarves all over him and everyone's very happy. But at the same time, somebody, one of the rangers, I think, voices some sort of criticism. Or no, he says the free dwarves must be free, and then starts to, get ushered away by King Golok's guards, which is the bit that I find quite fun, which is that you've got all these, you know, rather free dwarves in a sort of stultifying society ruled over by essentially what appears to be a dictator in King Golok, who, you know, brooks no nonsense. And there would appear to be a great tension in that kingdom now. Is there going to be a revolution? Is King Golok going to stamp down on these new dwarves in his territory? Will there be a dwarf civil war? Will there be a revolution? And what character might be heroic enough to gain enough impetus to perhaps lead it? And I think maybe Bannock Kolarn could do that, because he's a big hero.
Exactly, exactly. So, I mean, that idea that there is a seed of evil even in good forces or nominally good forces, and that, you know, perhaps now that the immediate threat is eliminated, then you get into those deeper stories of this defining what it is to be a dwarf. You know, can there be multiple dwarf communities, or do they need to unite under their king? You know, you can make a lot of different arguments, and I think that makes them more interesting than just, you know, we're craftsmen, we like golden beer, we don't like goblins, blah,
yes.
blah, you know.
Yes, absolutely. I confess to a very personal interest. I really like King Golok from... He's not featured much in the fluff, but I imagine him to be really, really quite nasty, but always, you know, having that thing of putting the kingdom first and making all the tough political choices. And he doesn't have time for any niceties or the idea of being good. He's ruthless, but perhaps, you know, in good alignment by name alone. And I think a lot of stories could happen involving him. I mean, there's another disgraced dwarf character from way back in the, I think it was the edition one fluff, who was running around with the free dwarves. There's these other characters, the other special characters who could possibly provide an opposition to Golok. And Golok, just to talk a little bit further about the Clash of Kings, there's a new unit for the dwarves called Golok's Fury, which is a giant steel behemoth with a massive gun on it. Presumably he had this constructed because he was victorious, or he had it constructed in order to fight this conflict. And the fact that it's named after him does seem a little bit egomaniacal, to say the least.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was really interesting. But the elemental, you know, that's another potential philosophical difference that you could explore, because the stone priests are as close as we get to any sense of dwarves having a religion so far in what's been explored. And so if you're looking at the stone priest, you know, practicing something where they're, you know, devoted to, you know, a form of nature worship, or maybe it's ancestor worship, we don't know. And then creating a piece of art, you know, if they're creating an elemental construct as an act of devotion, but then suddenly discovering that maybe they're entrapping a spirit. You know, is that something that is consensual?
And maybe they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe spirits are coming in and they're just assuming that it's magic animating them, but actually they're calling spirits up and forcing them to go inside these rocks.
Exactly, exactly. So it's that line between, you know, is this magic, or is this, you know, an act of faith, and whether or not something is coming as an act of will versus an act of faith is kind of an interesting division to explore. And so you have that other aspect of, you know, if you're looking at from the perspective of Golok, as you just, you know, outlined him, I think it would be a might makes right kind of argument, where it doesn't really matter which it is. But then if it comes out that we're like, wait, you know, we're supposed to be respectful and we're entrapping these things, perhaps against their will, we need to explore that further, then that's another thing that could go into the arguments of the free dwarves. You know, maybe...
Yes, that's a good point.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe, you know, at that point, you're looking at, is this a weapon or an ally? Because Kolarm has formed a friendship with one of these things, and it seems like that is uncommon for them to have any sort of expressed personality.
Yes, it's almost like a sort of earth elemental rights movement could spring up amongst the free dwarves alongside their existing political grievances and unhappiness.
Yeah, which could basically, you know, be, I guess, the fantasy equivalent of like a no nukes policy.
Yeah.
If they're suddenly like, well, you know, I know they're the most effective weapon we have right now, or something that has been part of our culture, but we have to abandon that.
Yeah.
Because it's ethically wrong.
I think that's fascinating. I hadn't thought of that. I think with Kings of War, especially with this fluff, you can create stories on so many levels, and you've got political stories which you could have regarding Golok and the Free Dwarves and all that sort of stuff. But then you could have what would be perfect for a short story in an anthology, say, which would be a sort of dissertation on the nature of the Stone Priests, religion, Earth Elementals, how it all works, the ethical problems, and so forth. In a sort of microcosm, that would be a wonderful story.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as people who are very interested in fluff in terms of that informing your playstyle and what you're building, having a Stone Priest be more than a stat block. You know, they're useful. There are certain things that you really want them to be able to do in a game to make your elementals more effective. But understanding, you know, what the motivations are behind that type of person and their cultural significance can sort of take it to a different level.
Yes.
Especially with, you know, that popular Rocks and Brocks list. So if those guys are out in the hinterlands, what does that say about their spirit?
There's an inference in their game statistics, even, that they're a little bit more than a weak priest, because they have two attacks. They've got quite good nerve. They're pretty tough compared to other magic users in other armies. So I've always assumed that this meant that they were quite hardy outdoor individuals, perhaps druidic in nature.
Well, yeah. And so with that, you wonder, you know, is there part of the elemental nature of stone that they're pulling into themselves? You know, is there a part of their dwarven spirit that is either supplemented or replaced by elemental spirit? So are they becoming kind of a hybrid in the process?
Yes, and they would definitely be therefore on the side of the Earth Elemental Rights movement.
Right. So if that goes one way, if they're hybridizing, then that could be how you discover that it goes the opposite direction. That some of the dwarven personality traits may be seeping in and be expressed in a way that they haven't been before. So maybe that's something that you would see through increased usage of elementals in war. Like, if they're doing this a lot more than they have done in the past, then there may be more instances of something like Kragoth appearing.
This is good stuff. This is good stuff. I know that Mark wasn't happy about the results in Rindu Forest, because it was a pretty big victory for the dwarves, and yet somehow it feels like they didn't win.
They did not win, and I am very, very upset about it. So I even sent a note to Rob Berman and said, Berman, what is this garbage? You know, he's like, well, you should have seen what happened if they lost. It's like, oh, come on now. We worked really hard. I mean, come on. The Free Dwarf should have been pushing up towards the Abyss, not getting their butts kicked all the way back to go visit King Golok. So,
well, I know, speaking as a Dwarf player who played a lot of games and reported them, I was like, well, okay, fine. did all that work for nothing, clearly.
Well, I mean, that takes it back to the narrative perspective, though. So in the campaign, you know, okay, Rob's got a stance that there could have been something much worse that you didn't see, because of all your hard work in trying to fight the good fight. But in having this become a potentially more complex story, when you have two versions of what the dwarf life should be, who are now forced to be living together once again, that's really interesting to explore. So
yes, I do agree. I think it's that conundrum of, what do you do if good wins? Does everything just stay the same? Well, that's really boring. There's nothing to put in a book about that. So although it was a victory, they have to make it, you know, perhaps a hollow victory, perhaps a more complex situation having evolved. So I really think that's quite a good idea.
Well, it also feels, and this might sound weird, but it feels dwarfy to me to have a win and a loss at the same time, to have it be, you know, complex or layered or bittersweet. Feels like a very appropriate dwarf thing. Like, yeah, they had to destroy this thing. I mean, you know, a bridge, a beautiful, you know, a construct that required skill had to be destroyed, and a way of life had to be destroyed in order to prevent a greater loss.
And even if it was the bridge made by the Abyssal Dwarves, it's still pretty impressive.
Yeah, I hear you, Jordan, and I still think it stinks.
Well, I hear you, Mark, and I understand. I was on Team Undeath for this one, so, you know, my views are skewed.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with the dwarves flying the banner high and pushing forward, and the Free Dwarf showing up King Golok. You know, that's what I was hoping to see.
Well, yeah, that's all good stuff. I think we should move on to another part of the fluff. In Clash of Kings 18, the overall solution to the expansion of the Abyss was that the Trident Realms helped the Green Lady basically melt the frozen sea and drown the Abyss. Apparently the ogres were consulted because their lands would have been destroyed, and they said, hey, yeah, whatever, do what you like. And more importantly, the Brotherhood lost what was left of their lands, which will make Brotherhood players even more annoyed. There's a reference made to the Captain's Council, which I'm assuming is all the leaders getting together and talking to the Green Lady. But that was never really made clear. But there's a little bit of fluff at the end saying to the effect of that something deep in the Abyss has been woken up by all the water cascading down into the deeper levels and has vowed revenge. So I wonder what that could be and what Mantic's plans are for that. Anybody have any ideas?
Oh, well, firstly, I thought it was really interesting that... There are a couple things in there that drowned that I thought wouldn't be capable of drowning.
The Mythicans.
Well, I mean, yeah. So the Mythicans, for one, and I understand if they're, you know, being forced through a raging torrent, which pipelines them into a nice plummet into the Abyss, that, you know, there's a lot of ways they could buy the farm there that are not necessarily drowning. So I'm letting that one go. But the fact that all of these lesser Abyssals drowned was interesting to me. And it was because the water was magically charged, like it was magically thawed, and that was part of it? Or was it because they're more corporeal than I've been thinking? I've been thinking of them just as devils and imps and things like that, as opposed to a more physical life than I had thought they had before. Did that strike you at all?
No, it didn't. And now I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking that's quite interesting, especially since it was the lower abyssals who, you know, are not as powerful as the other ones. Maybe they actually have human bodies that are then sort of mutated into lower abyssal forms. Maybe they were humans.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe there's a continuum there, or, you know, or it was some other form of life that was changed and transformed. But then, yes, I mean, whatever is down there, at the furthest levels, it mentions a distortion of time and space, basically, that there's reality is different, so that this torrent that's happening up at the upper levels is, you know, just so much gentle patter of rain on the roof to whatever this thing is.
Mm.
And there was mention of you know, some sort of conflict at the fourth level, and I was thinking, all right, are there gates between these things? You know, are there portals? Because then if you have to, as heroes, go down those levels, are there incantations you need to know? Are there items that you need to hold to be able to access a gate as reality, time, space, the ways, the laws of the universe shift the deeper you go into that jagged cut of the Abyss? Because, I mean, as we know, the Abyss was formed through, you know, an incredibly crazy, powerful, magical event of you know, epic battles of celestial forces. So, I mean, what does that do? How does that, the kind of deepest point of that axe rend in the world, since that's where the, you know, like the force of that formational foundational conflict in the world sort of terminated there?
I think that's interesting. I think it would be great to be able to flesh that out, because it's always presented as a sort of just being underground. I think the only way you can really represent it in a painting, for example, is, oh well, it looks hellish, it's fiery, it's underground, it's a little bit Hieronymus Bosch. But you could get that over much better in print, I think.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that it's interesting to think that the traditional sort of hellscape look that is accessible for us, that may literally just be scratching the surface of what the Abyss is and can be.
Yes, I agree. And I think fleshing that all out would be a wonderful thing to see. I think, you know, a lot of the fluff that Mantic have produced so far has been very much at the top level, very much a very general describing epic things. But little tiny stories that just detail exactly what's involved with these things, you know, would be absolutely amazing. Okay, so we've got that. Oh, and importantly, of course, that indicates that the Abyss is not destroyed. It's probably only the upper levels that have been damaged, and so it can come back and fight another day.
Right. Well, the way I envision it, Dan, is that, you know, you've got that distortion of time and space you guys were talking about. There's like, you know, the Abyss is really large, and it's a cut into the surface of Mantica, so you've got the rings around it. Now, whether or not the gates between the different levels, but I think of it as kind of like that distortion field, because they said that the Abyss has been filled with water. Well, I envision that field is protecting the lower levels, and that the upper bowl of it is full. So those creatures didn't have the opportunity to do anything but drown, I guess. But, you know, do they have actual lungs, blah, 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 you know. But I think that's very, very interesting. So, and, you know, after talking to Wing Tsar Publishing and everything, you know, a lot of these questions are going to have to be answered by us.
Sure.
You know, in the short term. And it'll be very interesting to read the first story in War Kings regarding the Abyss. That'll be very good. And then, I mean, the next book that's slated to come out is basically Forces of Nature book. So, you know, there's a lot of fertile ground here for the fans of Mantica to, you know, put together as well on that lower level. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it's just starting to open up, which is great.
Yeah, sorry. I just wanted to also cover the idea of the change in the geography, because you now have a massive, massive inland sea covering the Abyss, right?
Yep.
So that, you know, at some point, if you have to move a lot of people, a lot of evil people for an invasion, you could sail them across that. So that you know, that changes things a little bit in how people move about. If you're, you know, trying to do something desperate for trade or exploration, you could use that inland sea as well. But then you've got a bunch of abyssals and something that apparently didn't get drowned deep down there. So what kind of things might change in that situation? If things can be warped in time.
Right. And how do they get out of there?
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, are you going to see something kind of like a, you know, an H.P. Lovecraft deep one out of this situation? Like, you know, will they adapt and change? Will we see new forms of those lesser abyssals that are aquatic? Because that would be scary.
There's the abyssals that are being produced for Vanguard, which some of which are different troop types that we've seen before. And I wonder whether they'll tie that in with the changes that might have happened in the Abyss.
And one of them has rather kind of a crab-legged bottom, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just thinking along those lines, knowing that there are kind of icy versions of the Trident Realm stuff as part of the Northern Alliance. You remember we saw some preview art for those?
Yes, that's right, yeah. Interesting.
So I'm just wondering, you know, if this offers us an opportunity for a new take on some Abyssal stuff.
Yes, that would be a pretty good direction for them to go in.
I was just going to say one other thing that really struck me. You mentioned the Brotherhood and how people might be feeling a bit chapped about you know the physical loss of their lands. Mm. But I think what's interesting about that in Mantic's desire to take these, you know, somewhat orphaned concepts and give them a new home in Mantica. It seems like, you know, it seems sort of unfair to say that and then take away the land. But that does something interesting for Brotherhood, which is that it makes them about the Brotherhood is an idea, not a place.
Mm. I think that's a hell of a lot more interesting than their status quo situation had been, in which they, as you said, they've been a sort of a legacy carryover. And as we've heard, Mantic may want to put their own stamp on these legacy armies in due course. So that would be a great idea. A lot of Brotherhood people that I've spoken to who play Brotherhood are very, very into the Northern Alliance as well, and think, well, basically the Brotherhood could go and join them, which would be interesting.
I actually love the idea that the Brotherhood is a thought, a feeling kind of thing, you know, but I got a feeling they're not going to get clipped off. I got a feeling that we're going to scratch out our own land somewhere. And in my own view, I think the Northern Alliance is going to be tied with the Varangir somewhere. If you listen to my interview with Ronnie, we were talking about the similarities in the models and things like that. And I think that they're going to build off of that.
Yes, because there was a thing in Vanguard where the Northern Alliance riders of the big beasts were the beasts were said to be relatives of the Direfangs, which the Varangir ride. So, yeah, there's a connection, isn't there? Moving on to the next realm, Hawkman with the Empire of Dust fleet gets destroyed by a massive Kraken. And this is the story that I found a little bit annoying. Basically, the Kraken then decides it's going to go home in its enraged state to the Trident Realms and smash all that up as well. And Ector decides he needs to chase after it in a sort of Tom and Jerry situation. But I didn't feel like the fluff moved on at all. Yes, undead fleet destroyed, Trident Realms victorious. Oh dear, what wow, the Kraken's going to go and destroy our own place. So, you know, that might produce some interesting results, but I kind of thought that didn't really move on in any way. What do other people think?
I, Yeah, I mean, it just it didn't really land for me in that, you know, I like the undead stuff. I like there's a beautiful range for the Empire of Dust. And I was kind of hoping for, I don't know, a little bit more insight into them rather than just there's a big fleet of baddies. That felt a little flat to me. However, I also really like the Trident Realm stuff and the concept that they have to summon things like these giant kraken. And can lose control of them is a really interesting thing. Because, again, you're dealing with that kind of like weapons of mass destruction situation where, okay, should we be doing this? You know, if we suddenly have a rogue kraken, you know, running about, that's a terrible thing. And the idea that there had to be this agreement among the three kingdoms to even do this, you know, for want of a better term, the Triple Crown, had to come to council and say, yeah, we should awaken this thing. What are the other alliances, balances of power, all these things on what, for all intents and purposes, is a world within a world? They're separate. Like, very few things can actually interact with them beyond elementals if they don't choose to leave, you know, the waters.
That's true. And so, that's not something that comes over in game stats, the idea that certain units, you know, take some time, take some elaborate ritual or some power to summon to the battlefield.
Yeah, and another thing, like, do you remember there was a reference early on where the Green Lady was sort of, you know, doing her eye in the sky camera view of different things, spiritually speaking, around the world, and heard the Mythicans and their tongue was alien to her?
Well, I think Mythicans are quite interesting in themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, the Mythican, people joke about the like little Cthulhu octopus guys, but you know, if their language is unfamiliar to basically the personification of nature from time immemorial, what does that say? Where do you go with that?
Yes, and their sort of Cthulhu faces are also a little sort of nod towards the fact that perhaps they know a little bit more than they're telling. Maybe even the other elements of the Trident Realms don't know an awful lot about them.
And I like how
you typified that the Trident Realms is a sort of assortment of tribes, isn't it, really? And they've got to have agreements between each other. They've got to have relationships and things like that, but they don't necessarily know everything about each other.
Yeah, so, I mean, there again, it's sort of similar to the dwarves in that you have a place where, you know, most of the time they're goodies, but it's not entirely black and white. And, you know, this could give us an opportunity for them to have to look at, you know, if you treat the Kraken as essentially like the Mongol horde and the Trident Realms as multiple European principalities having the decision in front of them to join forces or to maybe let the third party fall and the two of us will work out a deal. We'll just make sure that they suffer the worst. So there's all sorts of interesting, I guess, non-binary ways that you can go with that. And it's, you know, especially cool because they're a neutral power. Like, it's an open book.
Yes, absolutely. Some of the fluff about the Thule creatures is that, I'm just reading here, it says, Ector has never understood the motives of these strange creatures, but he knows they can always be relied on in times of peril. So, yeah, there's definitely a kind of mystery being set up. And it's sort of a little bit like a sort of comparison would be Chewbacca in Star Wars. You know nothing about it. He seems to be a good guy. He says occasionally and does stuff, but you don't know anything about his home life. He could go home and, you know, do oil paintings or, you know, play chess or whatever, or be, you know, incredibly intellectual. You're just assuming that he's a big bear thing. You know, with the Mythicans, you're assuming that they are, you know, that they're as sentient as you are, but maybe they're more sentient. Maybe they're geniuses. Maybe they know how the world works.
I'm looking forward to more of that as long as we don't explore it through the Thule Mythican Christmas special. Let's just never go there. It's a dark and frightening place.
Let's not do that. There was one question I had, actually. In the original Edge of the Abyss book, they make a lot about Ector having a thing called a Kraken Maw, which is an ancient horn that can summon an ethereal tidal wave containing the ghostly visage of a kraken. So I'm a bit confused now as to whether there was a real kraken, whether there was a tidal wave. Did he use the Kraken Maw to summon the kraken? Did he use it to summon the tidal wave, which went into the abyss? I'm not quite sure there was a catch on that one, whoever was writing the first book and then the second book. I'm not sure that makes any sense necessarily. But you could make it make sense.
Yeah, I think that can work really well if basically like there's the idea of the Kraken in the waves, like the spiritual form of it, but it can't fully manifest. And that's where you need the Thule Mythicans to boost it in order to make it a fully corporeal thing. So maybe those things died out long ago and they've actually managed to make one again. They've kind of done this weird sort of Thule Mythican Jurassic Park situation.
Yes, and there's a combination of magic and kind of you create something biologically, but then the Mythicans have to somehow stabilize it, and you use some sort of magic to imbue it with the spirit of the Kraken or something.
Well, and again, throwing back to the weirdness of this, I didn't know if it was because they were attempting to have this conversation underwater or on the surface, but Ector was communicating, like the Thule Mythican that said, "We can't control it, it's too strong," was communicating through sign language.
Which you'd have to do if you're underwater, possibly.
Right, or if you speak a language that is alien to everyone else, as is referenced with the Green Lady not being familiar with their way of speaking.
Well, and going off on a weird tangent, I recently watched Justice League, which has Aquaman in it, and this seems odd, but bear with me. I was actually quite impressed with the way that film actually portrayed underwater fighting and underwater communicating and things. And there was a lady who was an Atlantean or something, and in order to talk to Aquaman, she kind of created a bubble, and they went and stood inside it, and then they could speak English and communicate with each other because he's not quite an underwater person. So you assume that underwater people can talk to each other underwater without doing that in some way, with possibly sign language, possibly some sort of releasing a smell into the water, maybe even, or creating some sort of echo location thing. But then when they want to talk to someone who isn't an underwater person, they create these little bubbles, which I thought was quite interesting and could be something related to Trident Realms.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting as well, and how forces were used underwater. Like, you can a concussive force used underwater to smash people against walls and whatnot. I'm mentioning that in terms of making those bubbles where you can function the way you would in a different environment. I've always thought that has to be part of Trident Realms. Because, the River Guard, yes, they can, they're obviously amphibians. They can hop about, no problem. But there are other things that would just, be kind of a weird squidgy pile if you took them, depth horrors. Depth horrors, are not the toughest anyway, stat-wise. So I'm imagining that it's the kind of thing that in the real world, if you were to take it from the abyssal plane of the ocean and bring it up to the surface, it would just sort of, be a bit of a stew by the time it got to the battlefield.
Yeah.
So, but if you could create basically a reality bubble around it that allows it to function as though it's in its native environment, no problem. Also, that helps to explain Ensnare for me, for things that don't have nets. Yeah, so your sword's swinging through the air, right? And it suddenly hits into this bubble. Now suddenly it's slowed down. It's acting as though you're swinging through water.
Nice. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's really good. This is awesome stuff. Right. Moving on a little bit. The Ardovician Plain. Well, this seemed to be the place where evil players didn't even try and win. the Orc players were not represented well. Basically, they lost miserably. I think it was possibly the best result for the good players that there could possibly be. I'm not quite sure that many battles were done there. So the ogres and men repulsed the invasion. And what I find most interesting is there's this new character called Lord Darvled, who appears to have risen to power as a result of this victory, as often happens in history, and is exhorting the kingdoms of men on to greater glory and saying, we've done this, we can do more. We've built a great big wall. It's, we've repulsed the orcs. Aren't we amazing? Which, as we all know from the lessons of history, that never ends well. I also wondered if the name Darvled was an anagram of something. So I put it into anagram calculator, but I don't think it is. But it just feels like an anagram to me. I don't know why. He seems to be building a power base. And then there's a little bit in the fluff that says that they've installed spikes on the inside of the wall, which Grokka Magot conjectures is to keep their allies in, not the enemies out. So do they intend to hold on to the services of the ogres forever? I can't imagine Grokka Magot's going to take well to that. Any thoughts by anyone?
One thing that I thought was interesting in this was that I'm just going to shorten the names, but Grok and Norm having their discussion, I thought it was interesting that they were kind of your cipher for kind of like a Fafhrd and Grey Mouser type situation, where I could see these guys as mercenaries traveling all over the place and being an endpoint And it was interesting to have your endpoint to a situation not be a human, but to have these ogres traveling and then going, I don't know about this guy. This seems kind of sketchy. What's going on? And I'd love to see that explored because they had some of the most personality of any of the characters that they've been working with. And that was surprising to me because I thought they just looked like, you know, big, nasty, burly ogres. The idea that ogres could be, you know, very canny, very savvy about a situation in the way that Conan as a barbarian often is if you read the books.
Yes, he's a lot more savvy than he comes across in the films and things like that.
Yeah, so there's a lot more wit to them than I had seen before, and I thought that was a cool thing to explore. But yeah, I definitely don't trust this new lord guy. and he had a for me anyway. I was thinking like, this is a very Game of Thrones sort of feel.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I didn't get the original reference about that you made with Grock and Norm, but I'm assuming it's a sort of, to go back to Star Wars again, it's the C-3PO R2-D2. They're the people that explain the world to everyone else, to the audience, as it were, and, you know, go through an adventure and experience it and comment on it, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, they could be going all over the place and be giving you kind of a digest version of things happening in Mantica based on their travels.
And it's always good to have a perspective of something else on something that's perhaps normal. So the reason I find that story was quite interesting as it was ogres talking about humans or ogres looking at humans, and the humans are a little bit alien to them.
Yeah. So I thought that was an interesting approach because otherwise, you know, as humans with something that's a little bit closer to our own real world history, it might be harder to make that compelling. But like you're saying, having it described by an outsider might make you pay a bit more attention.
Cool. Well, that's good. Moving on to the next bit, Forrested Gala here, also a good victory. Grogger's goblins were defeated, but he had visions. He had a vision that either he would reign supreme or he might get killed by an earth elemental with blue crystals. He also had a vision of riding on top of a giant goblin war machine with massive jaws. So I don't know if that, like the bit about the Abyss earlier on, presages some sort of new unit type or miniature coming in the far future that goblins ride on. But I like the idea that perhaps he's killed by Kragoth in the future, if that vision comes true. But anyway, goblins defeated in that realm. I don't think there's necessarily any knock-on effect from that bit of fluff. But moving right on to the Twilight Glades, of course, the Nightstalkers are definitely here, and Mantica will never be the same again. Are we setting up for them to be the next big bad? What do you think, Jordan?
I think definitely. There's so much potential there, and starting with their first kind of entry point into the world being through the upcoming skirmish game, Vanguard, that's just going to be a really cool thing to explore, starting with them being small yet scary problems. But this is this, you know, lovely kind of Stranger Things situation. You know, as far as we know, they're basically from a fantasy upside down. We have no idea what's on the other side of where they came from. And we know from the fluff that's come out so far that they've been twisted by being trapped, having their souls trapped in this realm. So, you know, the idea that you have a bad guy that even the other bad guys don't really understand. It's completely new.
You can't necessarily interact with them in the normal ways. Can you touch them? Can you communicate with them? Or, you know?
Yes. So with that, I mean, you can't go, okay, well, we're all evil together. We'll have a temporary alliance. They could just be this scourge upon the world.
Yes.
That might force alliances between factions that would normally be at each other's throats.
Just like the Abyss forced alliance basically between the Varangur and the other good races during the campaign. So, you know, to battle back the Abyss. So, and you know the Nightstalkers are the new big bad because, well, they're the featured faction in Vanguard coming up against the Vassalians. So they are here. And the cool thing is you've got two big bads going at it. So the Abyss and Nightstalkers are certainly, I'm sure, going to be tangling. So very, very interesting.
The Nightstalkers are here to eat everyone's souls. They're not prejudiced.
Right.
They don't care whose souls they munch on. So that's basically it for the main fluff of the book. A few questions remain unresolved. Lots of the units seem unrelated to the campaign fluff. Some of them do. Magnild has changed in huge ways and merged with Herja.
I really liked that.
Yeah.
I mean, not having gone to the bother of creating a model for the character myself, I wasn't bothered by her loss. But the idea that you have this kind of fused twin soul thing goes way back to the idea of the gods and powers being divided, right?
Yeah.
So the Fenulian mirror shattering. So this is the idea that Corrigan is like, you know what? Sure, go at it. That's the first view of anything like a personality that we've had to Qorgon. Being like, yes. Yeah, this is really nuts. Yeah, go for it. I like the fact that this is a completely crazy thing for you to be doing.
Great. Yes, I agree. I put it in the notes. Would it have been better if Jarvis had been responsible for that merging? And I only say that because in the Clash of Kings 2018, we don't hear anything about what happened to Jarvis. We don't hear anything about what happened to Artackle. We don't know what Mounty Busu did, how they interacted with the campaign, which is where I have to express my disappointment with the conclusion of the campaign, because these heroes were set up as, these amazing models and amazing characters, and then they seem to have disappeared.
Supposed to get that source book in December to clear all this up for us, and each of the characters was supposed to get a spotlight and the whole nine yards. So I agree, I was totally disappointed when the COC 18 came out for the wrap-up, and we didn't get a resolution. Like, we were supposed to find out if they lived or died, you know, basically.
That's right.
That was it, remember? I mean, the big thing was these characters could die depending on the results. Well, there should have been a lot of evil death, so with good sweeping across. So I was very disappointed in that myself.
Yeah. A lot of people were very attracted to Jarvis.
I definitely understand where you're coming from that, on the disappointment for wanting this resolution. But on the other hand, they were just introduced, and there's been kind of a dearth of characters that you can really latch on to in the fluff so far for the game. So having all these new ones come out, I am actually glad that we have had a little time to get to know them, and that will make their eventual deaths, if they happen, more meaningful. You know, when you really, that could be something that you're fighting for, is not, you know, does your faction control this bridge? Does this rift in time and space get closed? What have you? But does your favorite character die or not? Or is there a real complete bastard of a character that you just want to see put in the ground forever?
Screenwriting, you have to earn that sort of thing, don't you? You have to earn a heroic death or whatever. You've got, and the only way you can earn it is by having these characters do other things before they die and have a bit more life to them.
Exactly, and limiting them to doing those other things in a mass battle situation where essentially you've got this gigantic helicopter view of events and battles doesn't give you a chance to really explore their personalities that much. But Vanguard would, because you're telling smaller stories that link into larger stories. So they can exist in both games, and I think that may be why they didn't get killed off, is because now there's an opportunity to explore them and have them live in multiple game systems, even going down to the dungeon crawling level and having these three linked games where these characters can all live and have more life breathed into them before eventually their brief candles are snuffed out in narratively satisfying ways.
Well, it was something that I didn't include because I don't have access to it, is that, of course, they did have a Dungeon Saga supplement involving those characters. So maybe that's for another podcast, another time.
Yeah, I didn't pick that up either. My Dungeon Saga mojo is kind of gone, so.
In new units under Forces of Nature, the one I was trying to refer to was Agnith Banu, the Greater Fire Elemental. And that it may also be taken in Salamander's armies and is an ancient firstborn of the progenitor known as Ompek. So this is one where the spirit is actually like apparently tied to a celestial and is very much a divine spirit, elemental spirit with its own personality, kind of similar to Kragoth, but in a way that hasn't been described before.
Well, those are some really deep thoughts for us to consider as we go ahead and slide into our commercial break. And we're going to come back on the other side, and we're going to talk about something I think was completely overlooked and completely underappreciated from the Edge of the Abyss campaign.
Guys, we need a bumper to share with the other Mantic podcasts. No swearing allowed. Oh, real professional. The Fourth Snake is a UK-based Kings of War podcast presented by John.
I want to be an individual.
Dan. Nick.
Can I go to the toilet, please?
And Matt. You can find us on Facebook at OFFS and on Twitter at O4FootSnake. And you can find us on iTunes. That's 32 points of damage. Let's do a nerve check. Anything but Snake Eyes. Oh, for
I'm Grant Alexander from the Bexley Reapers, and you're listening to Countercharge.
And welcome back. All right, so what was this you were talking about, Mark? Well, what I was talking about was the Battle of the Glades starter set. This set is still available over on the Mantic website. It's $49.99 in pounds, $79.99 in US dollars, and $69.99 in euros. And this is a really cool set. What really makes it cool is the fact that it has this wonderful little storybook in it. And this really gets me fired up for the stories that are going to be told by fans and things like that, and in generation of scenarios and things like that. So really, really fired up about this. I think that it's something that you should check out if you do not have the armies that are involved. But this set contains everything that two players need to get started in Kings of War. It includes the Gamer Edition rulebook, the Battle of the Glades little book guide, and that includes the lore and the two starter force lists, and, like I said, the mini campaign, which is awesome, 20 hard plastic lower abyssals, 20 plastic succubi, 20 naiads, 20 of the salamanders, and then you get two medals in there, a metal abyssal champion and a metal druid. And, of course, they threw in the square bases. I think they should have put in unit bases, but you can hear that in my discussion with Ronnie, and of course your Mantic points. So, but the big characters in this little story is Lyrica, which I think is a cute little name there, and Farine. Lyrica is the abyssal champion, and Farine is the young druid. And the basic story involved there are the forces of the abyss are entering the forest of Galahir in search of a hidden glade of great power. And really what this great power is, this glade represents an area in the forest where the Green Lady, during the period of time when the Celestians were torn asunder, this is where she kept herself together. And it's created this rift in time and space, and it's an area of great power. So Lyrica has basically found out that if he goes to this space, that he can actually tap into the power of the Green Lady. So the little story here is, you know, all regarding that. And the story is cool. The little forces are super cool. There are three linked campaigns, which are just fantastic for you to do. The one thing that's a little odd for me is when you win the battles, you know, basically if you win the third battle, which is the battle for the glade, that gives you the big leg up on winning the campaign. But if the forces of the abyss win battle three and they win any other battles, then he was able to find the glade but not able to access it before reinforcements arrive. But if nature wins the third battle, okay, but they lost or drew all the other ones, all right, Lyrica was able to find the glade and decimate the guardians. It's only a matter of time before he finishes what he started. I think those should be flipped. So if you get to the campaign, flip those two, and it makes a lot more sense. But this set has got me incredibly excited. Number one, for a starter, so if you know somebody who doesn't play Kings of War, the other great thing this little booklet does is it gives you a two-page summary of all the history of Kings of War in two pages. So just to get you warmed up a little bit for the campaign and stuff like that. But if you've got friends that aren't playing Kings of War, that you want to get into it, you know, and they don't want to jump into a full army, or you've got kids you want to get involved with this, this set is awesome. The only thing it doesn't have are the multi-bases, and I certainly hope Ronnie and Mantic will correct that in the future. So have either of you guys seen this?
I've seen it when it came out. I think it really is the way to go, because I remember back with the back in the Warhammer days, they brought out something very similar which had named characters. I think it was the Island of Blood set, and it got a friend of mine and his son into Warhammer, and I think it's perfect for that sort of parent and child situation, because it's got the fluff, it's got the good and the bad, it's got all of that kind of stuff. I would like to see that rolled out a little bit more, really.
I think it's really great for people who are novice gamers, too, because if you're interested in it visually, then your next question might be, who are these guys and why do I care? And, you know, once you have some investment in that, then you might feel more compelled to learn the rules. Like, what might feel daunting or unfamiliar to you at first, you know, you might go, all right, let's play this. I want to see how the story pans out for us, you know, for our play group, as well as going, wow, you know, this character model did really well. I think I'm going to devote some time this weekend to painting him up. He deserves it at this point. You know, I've totally had that experience with models like, yeah, your stat blocks are killer and you're really great in game. I need to get some paint on you.
Yeah. It really enriches that side of the hobby, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Key parts of the set is they took a narrative approach to it, which is just, I mean, you get the rule book, but they give you this booklet that takes you through the scenarios, and they do. I mean, you're the leader of the Abyssal hunt that's going in there, or you're Farine and you're trying to defend the Glade. I mean, they set the story up perfectly and then lead you through three scenarios. It is not dry, mechanical, you know, here's the gamer rulebook, here's two armies, play the scenarios in the back. I mean, they put together the narrative to get you into the world, and I think this is awesome. I heard Ronnie talk about that they were going to change the starter sets up in the future when the campaigns come out, so I think we're going to see this one for another year, because we're not going to get a summer campaign this year for Kings of War. It's going to be Warpath / Dead Zone. So in 2019, I could imagine that that's going to happen. And the other thing I think possibly you could see in 2019 is Third Ed. So I think there would be a big tie-up with that, and you would get this. But I like the rotating starter sets with the new plastics. I really like that they put in, you know, the starter thing with the narrative. That is really, really cool. And the other thing is, it really, really gets you primed for the novels that are going to be coming out, because this first one is an anthology, and, you know, there's 10 stories in it, and it covers all the armies. So I'm really, really excited about that, and that's going to come out and, you know, get us ready for the next season of Kings of War 2, when, you know, COC 19 is going to come out in December. Then we're going to get a full-fledged novel in January, and then, you know, the tournament season basically starts after the Masters run, and then we can get going for the year. So I am very excited about the fluff coming up. Just really, really pumped.
Yeah, me too, Mark. My fluff mojo has been lacking recently. I've been playing a lot of quite competitive games, and it's been quite dry, and I've been thinking to myself, what I need is to immerse myself in the fluff once again, so it'll be great.
Yeah, that is great. I like, you know, when you said dry, I thought of that. And this is the anti-dryness. It's the narrative is the gravy of gaming for me.
Totally.
And this is fantastic, just to know that you have these, I don't know, not railroady scenarios. It sounds, from what you're describing, Mark, like you really do have a chance to kind of identify with a faction and, you know, play the one that speaks to you out of this and really work to further those goals that are set out for you. So what a wonderful way to have a learning environment for that, where you want to be able to tell the story that speaks to you and be part of that. And I think that's one of the things that makes, you know, faction play so interesting. And not to say that allies are not part of this, but for me, for a long time, you know, I played faction pure, just because I had such an investment in the ideas that were sort of formulated around that group. But then, you know, having reasons to bring different allies in is kind of grounded in the storytelling. You know, if it makes sense from a stats gameplay standpoint, but feels wrong from a fluffy standpoint, it doesn't quite feel right. So I like that's sort of something that you're getting from the ground up in here. Great. I hope I see more starter sets like this in the future. It's a really terrific way to get people going.
Yeah, they even gave the units unit names. So it was really, really, really cool. So, but all right, guys. Well, we're coming up to the end of our time here. So why don't we do some quick shout outs? You know, personally, I'm going to give a big shout out to EasyArmy.com. Greg is a huge part of our hobby. And, you know, head over to EasyArmy. And that is the best way to do your Kings of War list. So very, very cool. So go check that out. The other thing is, definitely wanted to give a shout out for Lone Wolf. It's going to be exciting. This episode is coming out on Lone Wolf weekend. So, you know, look forward to some more coverage of that. But big shout out to Mark Cox and the guys. I'm sure that we're having a wonderful time while you're listening to this episode. So any quick shout outs, Daniel?
Yeah, just a couple of tournaments. A shout out again for Bexley Reaper's Shroud of the Reaper tournament, which is in South London on the 21st of July. I think there's about 5 tickets left. There's also a new tournament called Kings of Hearts, which is going to be based in Hertfordshire, Southeast England. It's a doubles tournament. They have a Facebook page. Just look up Kings of Hearts. It's a new thing. We're all trying to support it just to get a little bit more Kings of War playing going in the area, because I don't think we're quite on a par with the US and certainly not with the north of England. So there's those two. Check them out.
Final thoughts, Jordan?
Shout out wise, I would like to just give a shout out to Mantic again for deciding to go really creative with a lot of their decision making. And I'd like to thank the community for continuing to up the ante, tell their own stories, be interested in finding a place for their story within what Mantica is doing, and also bring that to the table in terms of just, you know, really fantastically creative units in terms of painting, construction, basing. It's really inspiring to see the community working amongst itself and with Mantic in concert to create what's really a dynamic, different, and fun place for us to all share a story.
Well, I think you phrased that very well, Jordan. So, yes, a big shout out and thank you. And, you know, as we mentioned before, War Kings is coming out, and a nice tip of the hat to the community. Really excited about all the stuff Mantic is doing. So,
we need to remember the catchphrase and have it as our catchphrase on the narrative workshop, that narrative is the gravy of gaming. I really like that.
More gravy.
More gravy.
Absolutely. All right. Well, guys, thanks for joining me. I hope you gentle listeners have enjoyed this little dive into the fluff. And until next time, keep counter charging.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Countercharge. Please let us know what you thought of the show by emailing us at counterchargepodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at countercharge15, or by posting on our episode thread on the discussion forum found on manticgames.com. If you enjoy the show, you can help others find out about it by leaving positive reviews on iTunes. Until next time, keep countercharging. Music is a composition of Kevin MacLeod and is licensed under Creative Commons.